It's a bit of a cliche and sometimes the setup to a joke when someone says, trust me, I know what I'm doing. Shorten the statement to just trust me and you have the crux of our discussion in this hour. Maybe we don't stop and think about it much, but trust is really necessary for society to function. We have to have some faith that the people around us can be trusted to get their work done, and they have to trust us as well. We get a broad view of trust and its components and its issues in the book The Truth About Trust, How It Determines Success in Life, Love, Learning, and More. David Destino is its author. He's a psychology professor at Northeastern University, where he's the director of the Social Emotions Group. He's the author of many articles and the editor of the American Psychological Association's journal, Emotion. David Destino, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So just on a general level, are we learning a lot more about emotions and their sources as the years go by?
Yeah, we are. You know, there used to be this idea that the way to kind of succeed in life and make really good decisions was to be rather stoic and tamp those emotions down and just be logical. But I think what psychological science has been showing us is that, you know, emotions are just as helpful to decision-making as is clear analysis. And Lord knows sometimes we can get ourselves into trouble by rationalizing things we want to do through clear analysis. And so the trick to succeeding is knowing when to listen and value your kind of your intuitions and your emotions and when not to.
Ah, so that takes, it seems like a lifetime of training.
That's right.
Or experience.
That's right. That's right. That's right, exactly. And I think that's, you know, that's what, I mean, in my research program, we study lots of behaviors, but all of them are kind of related to morality in general. And what kept coming up time and again was issues of trust, whether we're talking about who should we follow as a leader, or who should we cooperate with, how do we make monetary decisions. This issue of trust pervaded everything. And so we spent a lot of time trying to understand how trust works and trying to correct some of people's misconceptions so that they can make better decisions for themselves.
Well, then I have to believe when you're talking about emotions and knowing when to follow those and when not to, that's really about trusting yourself, isn't it?
That is. It's about trusting yourself, but it's also about trusting yourself in an informed way because, you know, our emotions are useful to us, but they can lead us down problematic paths sometimes as well. And so, you know, one of the big, and this is a point we make in the book, one of the two facets of trust. One is integrity, right? That is, I have to trust that I myself or somebody else wants to do the right thing. But another important part of trust is competence. Does the person have the ability to do the right thing? Because even if they intend to do the right thing, if they don't have the ability, it's not going to end well. And so when you have to trust yourself, it's do I have the competence to be able to know when I should trust my intuitions or when I should not? And if you do, then I think you're going to have better outcomes.
Is there a good definition of trust at this point? I mean, is there a good way?
Yeah.
We didn't look at the dictionary for this, but you worked up one yourself, didn't you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you can, you know, there are, trust happens in many areas of life, many of which we're probably going to talk about. But the one thing that ties them all together is that when you trust someone, you recognize that you need someone's assistance to garner something that you couldn't do on your own. But in so doing, you're also making yourself vulnerable. So trust is anytime we rely on somebody else's integrity or abilities to achieve something that we couldn't do on our own, but doing so also entails risk and makes us vulnerable.
So, but apparently then there really is no good, hard and fast way to know if trustworthiness exists.
Well, this has been the problem. You know, people, if I have to decide if I want to trust you, what people normally do is they look back at somebody's reputation. You know, has this person been trustworthy in the past? Have they come through? But what science has shown us, you know, for a decade now of studying people's ethical and trustworthy behavior is that reputation isn't a great predictor. People's, you know, ethical behavior and trustworthiness is a lot more variable than any of us would expect. And let me give you a quick example. So in our lab, we'll bring people in, and we can only do certain things in the lab, ethically speaking. So we'll bring them into the lab, and we'll set up a situation for them where there's two things that can be done. And one is a short and fun task, and one is this long and onerous task. And we give them a coin, and we say, okay, we're going to trust you. Flip this coin and let us know which task it assigns you. Heads, you're going to do the fun task. Tails, you're going to do the short and onerous task. I mean, the long and onerous task. And we leave them alone, and they think they have anonymity. But, of course, we have cameras on them so we can see what they do. 90% of them, and this we found surprising, 90% of them either don't flip the coin and give themselves the good task, or flip the coin repeatedly to get the answer they want, which is like not flipping the coin, right? And so if you ask these people afterward, were you trustworthy, most of them say, Yes, but they'll condemn somebody else that we have them watch for doing the exact same thing they did. And so what's happening in these situations is our mind is allowing us to kind of get away with something because we think we're not going to be caught and there won't be long-term ramifications. And it's making us create a story for why it's okay and why we can behave in an untrustworthy manner. And these are just, you know, normal, upstanding people. And so what that means is everybody has the ability to be untrustworthy, especially as situations change and they think they can get away with it, even if it's non-intentional.
So we're really talking about situational ethics here.
Exactly. That's right.
Much more to talk about with David Destino. He's a PhD. He is a psychology professor at Northeastern University in Boston and the director of the Social Emotions Group and the author of The Truth About Trust, How It Determines Success in Life, Love, Learning, and More. Back with David Destino and your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today, Dr. David Destino, psychology professor at Northeastern University and the author of The Truth About Trust, How It Determines Success in Life, Love, Learning, and More, a whole way of learning about trust and how it functions both in our brain and in society and in our relationships. You can join us on the Exchange, please do, at 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Chapter one, you lay it out. We trust a lot just to maintain society. I mean, there's a whole myriad of ways in which we do this, which once you enumerated them, I guess I hadn't thought about it quite that much.
Yeah, I mean, we all, you know, can pick out the big things in our life. When I'm buying a major purchase, whether it be a new car or a house or starting a new business or whether I'm going to, you know, marry someone, but trust pervades lots of other things. You know, will my neighbor feed my dog the way he said he would? You know, is the car mechanic being trustworthy when he says, you know, my transmission needs to be fixed? It pervades almost everything we do, and oftentimes that means it's operating these decisions about whether someone is trustworthy operate kind of below our conscious awareness and guide our decisions. And I think that's why a lot of this book explores kind of the brain mechanisms that make that happen and how we can improve on them.
You know, it really does get the tail when you think about it. And you get into examples like banks. You're going to trust that the bank is actually going to hold your money and not lose it mm-hmm. on you, which, of course, was misplaced trust in some
cases. That's
right.
We've seen that happen recently, yeah.
But, you know, the fact that you trust that the date stamped on the milk carton is bona fide and that mm-hmm. you're not going to get yourself poisoned or get botulism or something when you bring it home.
Right, and that's the problem. You know, if we stop to try and figure out every single item, it would be almost debilitating. And so we trust. In some ways, trust is a shortcut. And so I trust the date stamped on you exactly on the food, et cetera. But the question is, you know, anytime we do that, there's a risk. And as we've seen, there are other people who are weighing the costs and benefits of profit in terms of being untrustworthy and getting away from it, whether they're putting things in our food that they shouldn't or whether they're skimming money when they shouldn't. And so, you know, a lot of my argument is trusting is good. We have to trust other people because if we didn't, we wouldn't get much done. But trusting wisely is better, and that's what this book is about, learning how to you know, be more accurate in those decisions.
So, David, when you say trusting pays greater benefits over the mm-hmm. long run, what does that mean?
Yeah. Well, trust, it really comes down to short-term gain versus long-term gain. So if I borrow money from you, Jeffrey, and I don't pay you back in the short run, well, I'm ahead. But in the long run, if I don't pay you back or keep doing this, you're not going to want to interact with me. And so the smaller aggregated gains I would get over time are going to outweigh the initial gain I got from you by borrowing the $20 and not paying it back. This happens in all ways. And so all the evolutionary simulations out there show that on average it's better to be trustworthy because we will in fact gain more over many years than not doing so. But of course there are times when our minds, when others' minds will actually push them to kind of be expedient, like in that example I gave before, when you feel like you can get away with it, your mind assumes there will be no long-term cost because no one will know. And so being attentive to the cues that can make people more or less trustworthy in a given situation become important.
So the people who do not trust other people easily, who are always a bit wary of others, do they lose out on a lot then?
They do. In fact, one of the best examples I have, you know, the last chapter of the book is called Trust or Dust. And what I mean by that is trust is what gets the engine of commerce working. And so when Superstorm Sandy hit New York City in 2012, there was just immense devastation in many parts of the city. And the AP did a study in the following summer looking at which neighborhoods got up and running, which ones were the most resilient. And the single best predictor of which ones were the most resilient and got commerce up and running quicker was the ones that had the most trust, where people trusted their neighbors the most, because that's what allowed people to begin cooperating in ways that they wouldn't in other neighborhoods. Now, of course, there were some people who price gouged and did things they shouldn't, and so trusting blindly is not a good thing. But in general, trust is what keeps the human condition moving along.
David Destino, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about his book, The Truth About Trust, How It Determines Success in Life, Love, Learning, and More. There's an email here from Jackie. She says, I'm looking forward to this. The book looks really interesting. My question, how does gender influence how and who we trust?
It's a good question. There are no clear differences in that are men or are women more trusting on average. However, what is clear is that the more similar people are to us, that is, the more we share something in common with them, whether it's a religion or an ethnicity, et cetera, or even a gender, the more likely we are to trust them. So it's the case that, you know, women will trust women more and men will trust men more, but on average, there is no gender difference that makes one sex more trustworthy or more trusting than the other.
Interesting. They're not as big a difference as we would have thought there. Let us take a call. Here is Paul in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Destino. His book is The Truth About Trust.
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen. I would just say that I don't trust psychological testing because at least the testing that I've ever been subject to doesn't reflect my emotional attachment or my values in the test. And if they had, they might find out that I'm particularly attached to a set of values that I might be very trustworthy about, but some abstract test, testing general values, is almost meaningless.
You mean it has to be tested in certain situations where you're really, you know, giving people a realistic scenario?
No, it's related to my personal value system. I can be very trustworthy about things that I value highly, but anything that lies outside of that zone is negligible. It is the flip of the coin that the doctor was talking about. Come see, come saw. Uh-huh. So my value system, the greater the emotional attachment I have to my value system is the key here. Towards trustworthiness. I'll save my child, but you can't trust me to save your child.
All right, we'll take it from there. Thanks for the call, Paul. Appreciate it. Dave?
Yeah, I think Paul is hitting on two important points that I agree with. Let me take them in turn. One is that trustworthiness is situation and domain specific, and this is the problem that a lot of people make. We assume that trustworthiness is a trait, and that if you're trustworthy in one situation, that means you're trustworthy across all issues. And as your caller said, that's not the case, even in his experience. And I think this is what leads us astray sometimes. We assume that trustworthy once, trustworthy always, across all areas, and our work clearly shows that it is much more situation-specific. The second is the issue of generality and testing. I think you're right. One issue that we do is we never ask people, are you going to be trustworthy, because what are they going to do? They're either going to say yes and lie, knowing they wouldn't be, or what happens more is they think they would be, but when push comes to shove, they actually aren't. And so when we study trustworthiness in the lab, We study it with real stakes. We set up situations that our people believe are real. We use actors, and we use real money as rewards or other benefits. So there are real immediate costs and benefits on the table, and then we see what people do when push comes to shove.
David Estino, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, psychology professor at Northeastern University and director of the Social Emotions Group. His book is The Truth About Trust, How It Determines Success in Life, Love, Learning, and More. Phone numbers on the exchange for this discussion, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, David, walk us through the prisoner's dilemma.
Yeah, the prisoner's dilemma is a game that was devised to actually study people's trustworthiness and willingness to cooperate or not, and it's been used for decades. And what it does is it sets up a situation between self-interest and common outcomes. And to make a long story short, the way it works is imagine there are two prisoners, and you are given, each of them is individually brought into different rooms and given the opportunity to either cooperate or to defect. By cooperate, I mean hold your story, don't sell out your partner, be trustworthy to him or her, or defect, which means sell him out. And the benefits and costs are structured in such a way that if both people are trustworthy, they get a good outcome, but not as good an outcome as if one of them is untrustworthy and sells the other person out, and that person is trustworthy. And so it's this. And so if you can trust your partner, then the best thing to do is not to sell him out. It's to remain silent and not to admit anything. If you can't trust your partner, then the best thing to do is to sell him out and maximize your own gain. And so this is a game that has been adapted in lots of ways. We play the game, but with money, so you earn different amounts of money. So if you both cooperate with each other and are trustworthy, you earn some profit. But if one of you cooperates and the other doesn't, you earn a tremendous amount of profit and the other person doesn't earn anything. But if both of you are untrustworthy, that's actually the worst outcome. And so it's a way to kind of understand selfish impulses versus being trustworthy to another person in a way we can study in the lab.
We move pretty quickly in the book from the prisoner's dilemma to TFT, or tit-for-tat strategy, which is you keep doing this, I keep doing it to you, which seems like it would erode trust over time. Is that a way a lot of us approach trust, though?
It is. You know, the tit-for-tat strategy means basically I will trust you as long as you're trustworthy to me, but the moment you cheat me, then I am going to write you off forever and never trust you again. And a lot of people behave that way, and that strategy in computer simulations tends to work fairly well, because what it does is it really makes people want to be trustworthy. There's one big problem with it, though, which is, let's say I accidentally act in a way that's untrustworthy. So I lost something you gave me, and I really wanted to be trustworthy, but I accidentally did something, or it was inadvertent. And then if you view me as being untrustworthy, you kind of write me off. And it sends us into a death spiral where we'll never cooperate again. And so the best strategy is really what's called generous tit-for-tat, which is where you allow some forgiveness. You allow for some noise in the system that if somebody's been trustworthy but, you know, it makes a mistake once, you forgive them and see if you can repair the relationship. Of course, if they keep being untrustworthy, then you write them off. But that ability to forgive overcomes some bumps in the road that would normally end, you know, collaborations or relationships that have the potential for long-term success.
So we give ourselves some leeway. I mean, it's human to make a mistake, I guess, is what we're saying.
It is human to make a mistake, and sometimes we're untrustworthy not because we intend to be, but because we make a mistake.
Let us take some more calls. Here's Jim in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Destino.
Yes, good morning. I wonder how many people look at trust in many cases as an absolute necessity. In the past, you had two slave-owning farmers on one side of the creek and the other. They absolutely had to trust that each other would send runaway slaves back across. Modern times, low-income, middle-income people with children, they absolutely have to trust that the school that their kids are assigned to is going to give them the best education available.
Right, and this is one of the bits that comes up in the book. Thanks for that, Jim. And David, that is a bigger one. I mean, you get into education a lot here, but it begins outside the actual school door, trusting that the people inside that school are going to do the best for your kids.
Yeah, two issues there. One, I hope we'll come back to later, deals with, you were talking about lower middle income people and power. And we know that as power and social class increase, trustworthiness decreases. So we'll come back to that. But let me address the point here about education. One thing we know in that work by my colleague Paul Harris at Graduate School of Education at Harvard is showing is that how much kids actually trust their teachers, not just like them, but actually trust them, predicts their academic outcome. And for example, they'll do research. This is by Mark Saba at Queen's University in Canada. What he'll show is that how well kids remember facts that a teacher tells them is dependent on how much they trust the teacher. So if I have two teachers there, one who they trust more than the other, they will actually remember the same facts from the teacher who they trust more than the teacher who they trust less, just because the mind intuits that this is a more reliable source, and so it encodes it more in memory.
Interesting. Stan in Ashland sent an email. He says, is there more trust within more equal societies?
Yes, there is, but no society will remain completely trustworthy because the by that I mean where everybody is trustworthy, because the benefits to be gained by being a cheat, especially where everybody kind of inherently trusts everybody else, is just too powerful. And so normally the trust level within a society is in an equilibrium. It ebbs and flows, but surely certain societies are much more cooperative than others. But as the power differential increases within a society, those who are at the higher end become less trustworthy because, simply by matter of fact, when I trust you, I'm making myself vulnerable to you. And if your outcomes don't depend on other people, you don't have to be as trustworthy to them because you don't need them as much as they need you.
All right, so this gets to what you were saying a second ago, where the power and social class increases and trustworthiness decreases. But but that works on the assumption that you really don't need anybody else?
Well, sure. So the your mind is always below your conscious awareness making calculations of whether or not you should take a short-term gain and be untrustworthy, or where it might hit your reputation, or act trustworthy for long-term benefit of cooperation. So the more power you have, the less you have to depend on others. Now, it doesn't mean that you don't have to depend on anybody, and it doesn't certainly mean that people who are of a higher class are never trustworthy. What it means is, on average, in all of the experiments we've looked at, and there's a lot of work done by a guy named Paul Piff at the University of California, Berkeley, who's shown that on average, the percentage of times people will behave in an untrustworthy manner are higher as social class goes up. But it's not a cultural part of being in the 1%. Even in lab experiments, if we put you in a situation where for a half hour you have power over other people, the odds of you behaving in an unethical way, the likelihood of you behaving in an untrustworthy way toward them, will go up.
Interesting. So it really is situational and what you perceive to be the advantage to you.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Let's take another call. We have Julie in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Destino, the author of The Truth About Trust.
Hello, thank you. I was wondering if in these studies, if there are actual measurements of brain waves as the person goes through their thinking process.
Let's find out.
Yeah. No. Brain imaging from a scientific standpoint is still in its infancy, and so we're learning more and more about the mind and the actual physical structures of the brain every day, but there is no way yet to predict whether someone is actually going to be trustworthy or not as a function of brain activity. If there were, you would see it used in court all the time, but actually many legal cases have actually banned it being used because it's just not sophisticated enough to make that kind of determination. Neither are polygraphs, really, although people tend to use them over and over again.
And you do get into some of the brain structures involved with trust, the vagus nerve and polyvagal theory. Can you describe what that's about?
Yeah, sure. So polyvagal theory is a model that was developed by Dr. Steve Porges, and the idea behind it is that as our positivity, the comfort that we feel increases, which is determined by the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve controls a lot of our physiology, and as the vagus nerve becomes more activated, it basically puts us in a calmer state. And if we're in a calmer state, then we feel safer. And therefore, we feel more willing to trust other people. And so one new promising avenue, although it's not completely tested yet, is that measuring vagus nerve activation as a predictor of if someone's going to be trustworthy or not.
So you talk about increased vagal tone. Does that mean, I mean, is it like muscle tone? Or just
It means more activation of the vagus nerve, which basically, if you've ever felt kind of anxiety and your heart thumping and feeling nervous and your heart rate increasing, the vagus nerve, if it's activated, is a brake on that. It calms it down. And so simply by calming down our physiology, it's a cue to the brain that there is less threat in the environment, which is going to increase the likelihood that we're going to feel comfortable and be willing to trust others around us.
The brain and society and all the other places where trust comes from and goes to. In the book, The Truth About Trust, How It Determines Success in Life, Love, Learning, and More. David Estino, its author, our guest, will return to this discussion on the Jefferson Exchange in just a moment. And you can join us as well. Back with David Destino and your phone calls and emails when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today, Dr. David Destino, psychology professor at Northeastern University, where he's director of the Social Emotions Group. He's the author of many articles, the editor of the American Psychological Association's journal Emotion, and the author of the book The Truth About Trust, How It Determines Success in Life, Love, Learning, and More. We're learning a whole lot about trust here today and where it comes from, both in the brain and in society. And you can add to this discussion at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, David, we've pretty well established at this point that trust is not a 100% thing. You're not going to either have it or don't. It all is based on the situation. But this, even this quote sort of surprises me. Everybody has their price, even if they don't know it.
Yeah, and what I mean by that can be just, you know, illustrated back by that example I gave you a minute ago. When we brought these people into the lab, they're just, you know, honest, trustworthy people. Everybody would assume that they were moral, upstanding folks. But 90% of them, even though they said they would flip the coin to see if they got the good or the bad result, didn't do it. And so what that tells us is that these folks, even though they predict they'll be trustworthy, won't be. Now, the interesting thing is when we asked them after, were you trustworthy, most of them said yes. But when we had them watch somebody else do the exact same thing they did, which was, you know, not flip the coin and just take the good task for themselves, they said that person wasn't trustworthy. And if we asked them why, they said, well, they created a story for why it was okay for them in this moment, why their not flipping the coin actually was okay. Well, they really had to be somewhere. Normally, they're trustworthy, but this time it was different. And what that suggests to me is that our mind, when we think we can get away with something, will rationalize a way for why it's okay for us to behave untrustworthiness, and in so doing makes us not change our view of ourselves as trustworthy, even though we were untrustworthy. Because if you think about it, if we didn't trust ourselves, the outcome would be horrible. We would never save our money for the future because we'd assume we would blow it. We're never going to eat correctly because we assume we're going to, you know, eat chocolate cake or drink too much tomorrow. And so we have to have the view that we're trustworthy, even though objectively, when we study people's behavior in science, we know that that's not always the case.
That's really interesting, though, to think that people would rationalize it to the point of, like, well, okay, so you couldn't trust me this time, but there's a good reason.
Right, there's a good reason, which means it's not that I'm not trustworthy. It means I just had to do something now. But that other guy did the same thing. Oh, yeah, that's a window into his soul. He's untrustworthy. Yeah.
When we try to talk about ways to determine whether people can be trusted, I mean, there is, you refer to the state of the art in trust detection, and you refer to the state of the art of trust detection as being rather poor at this point. But but there are people trying, you're telling us.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it's been the holy grail of research for a long time. You know, whether you're talking about security agencies or businesses or scientists trying to understand if we can predict the you know, untrustworthiness of others by their body language, and there just hasn't been a good way to do it to date. And if you don't believe me, go look up the congressional investigation of the TSA's program in 2010, where they spent $40 million on a program that was shown to be worthless. But we've actually been able to find some evidence, and the way we do it that's different than everybody else is we look for multiple signs at the same time. You know, everybody's wondering, oh, is it the shifty eyes that means you're untrustworthy, or is it a false smile? It's none of those things. If it were one thing, we would have found it a long time ago. What you have to be able to do is look for multiple cues in a computational way at the same time, because if touching my face means I'm nervous, how do you know if I'm touching my face it means I'm nervous or if I have an itch? You can't tell if you're looking at one. So what we've been able to show is by looking at multiple cues at the same time, we can disambiguate their meaning. And we've actually used humanoid robots for this, too, where you have people converse with robots where we control exactly the motions they make. And we're able to shift people's sense of how much the robot is trustworthy around by the nonverbal cues it gives off.
Has there been much crossover here with the facial action coding system and the search for micro-expressions, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that to date has been thought with the state of the art, and the fact that the TSA SPOT program is actually based on the facial action coding system. But what we're learning is that those individual micro-expressions just aren't reliable enough on their own for that exact reason, that, you know, it's hard to discern an overall intention from one cue that can mean lots of different things. Because lots of those cues combined in different ways mean different things. And so the field is beginning to move on from that system because it's proven to be unreliable.
Hmm. So back to biology, though. I mean, you pointed out in the book that we are encoded to trust. We are also encoded to not trust. I mean, mm-hmm. It's kind of like a mixed bag. We're so essentially biologically neutral, but societally, we do need to have trust with each other. Is that where it really comes into play?
Yeah, and even biologically, we have the capacity to trust and we want to trust. And in fact, if you meet a new person and you don't know whether to trust them or not, it's better to trust them than not, because the odds that they're going to be trustworthy and you have long-term gain is higher than basically being cheated one time. But what I say in the book is, yes, trusting is good, but trusting wisely is better. And so if you can really think about the situational factors like power or the nonverbal cues that you can read that will give you in that moment a sense of what this person is going to do, then you're going to have a much greater advantage. I mean, evolution didn't design us to be trustworthy, it designed us to be optimal. And sometimes being optimal means behaving in untrustworthy ways in terms of garnering resources.
In The Truth About Trust, you write that you smile when you watch experiments in fairness and trust with apes. Why does that make you smile?
Because there's wonderful work done on kind of cooperation and trustworthiness in our primate relatives. And because what you can see is that even lower primates, they keep track. And so, you know, there's these great studies done by Sarah Brosnan at Georgia State University where she'll have macaques do certain tasks. And, you know, what do you pay a macaque? They don't want money. They want treats. And so you can either give them a biscuit or you can give them a grape. And grapes are like, you know, gold coins in the world of macaques because they really love them. And so if one monkey sees another monkey getting paid in grapes for exactly what he's doing, he gets really mad. And it's not that he's mad that he's just not getting the grapes. It's mad that he's doing the same work and he's not getting them. And so even our primate cousins, who we would argue are not nearly as consciously sophisticated as we are, pay attention to issues of equity and fairness and cooperation.
Interesting. Let's take another call. Here's Sandy in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Destino, the author of The Truth About Trust.
Yeah, hi. Fascinating. Fascinating subject. I'm going to have to read your book. But from a quick search of your book, I noticed that you looked at attachment theory during the research, and I believe that attachment theory is an incredibly robust area of research generally, and yet the information about it doesn't seem to get out much to the general public. So I'm curious to know more about your research in that area, and I'll take my answer off here.
All right, thanks for that, Sandy.
Sure. I actually haven't done research in attachment theory, but I talk about work in the book that has been done. For those of you who don't know, attachment theory basically is a marker for how securely attached people are to caretakers, normally a mother and a child, and we keep that throughout life. You can either be securely attached, where you inherently trust the person, or you can be anxious, where you're not sure, or you can be avoidant, where you've learned not to actually trust this person. And what the work has shown is that in kids who are avoidant, who have learned that they can't always trust their parents, when you put them in new situations in academic learning environments, and their mother is giving them information and a teacher is giving them information, if they trust the teacher more, they will actually disregard factual information given by their parents in favor of the teacher. And again, why is this important? Well, when you're a kid, you're really vulnerable. That's probably the most vulnerable stage of your life. And so when you're learning, trust is important. You need to know whose information you can count on. And so it's not just a matter of who you're most familiar with. You know, kids who have poor attachment will ignore their parents and preferentially seek information from other individuals because they've learned over time not to trust their parents. And so it's another marker of how trust can affect early learning and academic success.
You get right down to the specifics with oxytocin, the so-called bonding hormone. There is a flip side here then, huh?
Yeah, you know, people, oxytocin has been called the moral molecule. And there's a real problem with that. You know, yes, if you have oxytocin, it tends to make people behave more trustworthy. But there's an important caveat. What is oxytocin if you really think about it? Oxytocin is a birth hormone. Those women out there who've had their labor induced, the thing that made it start was Pitocin, which is a form of oxytocin. And so what we're finding now is oxytocin will make you trust and be trustworthy more toward those who are like you, but it actually makes you less trustworthy and more aggressive toward those who are different from you. And it makes sense, right? Every parent thinks that their child is wonderful and will protect their child and that their kid is better than somebody else's kid. And so oxytocin works the same way. It doesn't make us all sit around the fire and sing kumbaya. It makes us bond to those who we already like, but it actually makes us more discriminatory and less trustworthy toward those we don't.
Ah, so we're essentially blocking out the people who we're not bonded with because we're not going to trust them as readily.
Exactly. So it's not a moral molecule. It's kind of like an in-group, out-group molecule. You can think of it that way.
Us and them.
Exactly.
All right. So if trust in parents is damaged, if the bonding is not good there, attachment is not optimal, I mean, are kids going to have a tougher time learning in general?
Not as long as there are other individuals in their lives who will serve as mentors. And so the important thing about trust is that, yes, if you have a poor relationship with your parents, it kind of sets your expectations, but those expectations are always being updated. And so if you can actually find individuals as a child or as an adult whom you do trust, because the capacity to trust is so innate and so important, it will happen. It will blossom again. It might take you a little longer. And that's why it is really person-specific. And that's why it's important, you know, not to have a teacher who's going to coddle you. The best outcomes from teachers who are a mentor, those who will tell you where you're wrong and provide information to help you become better.
So, as you point out, not a teacher you like necessarily, but a teacher you trust.
Exactly.
All right, so I want to move on to romantic relationships because we've got a few minutes left here. You describe romantic relationships as something like relational shorthand is the way it's depicted.
Yeah, trust. Yeah, exactly. I mean, in some ways, what trust does, when you learn to trust somebody, so, you know, you'll start a relationship oftentimes keeping track of them. Okay, I paid for dinner last time. Are you going to pay for dinner this time, or I did this for you? But once you're comfortable in that relationship, once you begin to trust your partner, you don't make those calculations anymore, and it kind of functions as you're saying, as a shorthand that everything's okay. And for example, if you inherently trust someone, if they do something that might normally make you go, like they're working late or they're traveling for business, that inherent trust makes you less likely to question anything that they're doing that might be a potential cause for concern, which is good. It smooths out the bumps in the relationships, because if they've proved trustworthy, hopefully they will be trustworthy. And so trust in relationships really is a glue that kind of, you know, keeps people together.
Well, then it gets back to what you're saying, though, about trust is something that pays off in the long term. And so if you do have that level of trust in somebody, you can accept the fact that there are going to be some short-term bruises along the way. But
that's right. And many of those bruises oftentimes are again, unintentional ones, that it's better to kind of work through than to go, oh, that's it, we're done, you know, and to lose all those benefits that you would have over time.
You go on for quite a while about jealousy and how that figures into relationships and where the trust is broken there. And it sounds like it really starts off with a mathematical situation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not trying to take the magic out of relationships, because we feel in love and it's a wonderful thing, but ultimately relationships at a very kind of, you know, biological level are cost-benefit, you know, structures. And so, you know, what I tell people is that jealousy is really about the future. It's not about the past. And the reason I say that is because if you're feeling jealous that you think your partner might be interested in someone else, that's a signal to you to repair that relationship before it's lost, right? And so what we've been able to show in our lab is we'll bring people in and, you know, we hire attractive male or female actors or actresses for them to interact with. And the actor or actress's role is to basically work on a task with the person, make him or her feel really comfortable, like them. And then we have another person come in who starts flirting with that actress. And so you can say, I've been talking to this person for 10 minutes. Oh, I like them. Oh, now they're interested in someone else. Within 10 minutes of meeting someone, our subjects are already jealous if that person is showing interest in someone else. And if that person chooses to go off and work with that someone else, our subjects will actually choose to seek revenge on them and cause them pain. Now, why would you do that if you only knew this person for 10 minutes? It can't be about the relationship. It's because your mind is thinking about the future. I have a potential with this person. And so let me protect this relationship and keep them trustworthy.
So, in other words, they even after 10 minutes, they almost feel like they've been dumped.
They do. They almost feel like they've been dumped. And we give them the opportunity to cause, of course, they don't actually cause the person pain, but they believe that they're going to have the opportunity to cause the person pain, and they take it. And that's why I tell people jealousy is really about keeping trustworthiness in the future, not about what's happened in the past. Yes, you can be angry about what's happened in the past, but jealousy is that feeling you have when you're worrying, is a trust going to be broken? And that's different than the anger you feel afterward.
Huh. So it's okay, so my heart is going to be broken?
Yeah, exactly. Or how can I better do something to prevent this person from breaking his or her trust with me and going off with someone else. You know, jealousy is what keeps us awake at night wondering, is my partner doing something that they're going to leave me for? Once they leave, you're not really so much jealous as much as you are really angry.
Hmm. And you do counsel us to trust our hunches in relationships.
Yeah.
What kinds of hunches?
Trust your hunches, because when we were talking before about how we're able to detect the nonverbal cues of others, we've actually been able to show that if we have people kind of negotiate face-to-face versus negotiate over the internet, even though the same amount of information is exchanged, when you're dealing with someone face-to-face, you're seeing their nonverbal behaviors. And our mind can build up an intuition or a hunch about what this person is going to do that we've shown is better than chance. And so when you have a hunch about someone, you don't have to blindly follow it, but don't disregard it. Consider it as an important piece of information, because evolution has honed your mind to have some accuracy with these hunches. It's reading cues that you might not consciously be aware of.
All kinds of fascinating stuff in the book. It's called The Truth About Trust, How It Determines Success in Life, Love, Learning, and More. David Destino wrote it, and he's joined us on The Exchange today. David, thank you.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. Tomorrow on The Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about the Meals on Wheels program in Cave Falls and the supply-demand disconnect that it's suffering through. We'll talk about 8:30 about the situation with AP, or advanced placement exams and classes, and opportunities missed for students in Oregon. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the creator of the 562 Project, creating some real photographs of real Native Americans in the here and now. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant is Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.